Radio in Cape Town.
When the most recent quarterly unemployment stats were unveiled, the country went into overdrive. There was much hand-wringing about a number so eye-wateringly large that one can scarcely believe the country manages to stave off a popular revolt. At 29% officially and closer to the mid-30s unofficially, the word crisis almost seems trite when it comes to unemployment in South Africa. On Thursday, President Ramaphosa will respond to questions in the National Assembly. We've got the likes of ANC MP Judy Hermans is expected to quiz the President about the government's plans to address slow economic growth and the rising unemployment rate. No doubt there'll be other opposition parties who'll be volleying questions his way on the state of the economy, which shrank 3.2% in the first quarter. Now, one man who's been pulled in to advise government on more than one occasion, between 2006 and 2008, he led a panel of international economists to advise Treasury on the Asgisa growth program. And in December last year, he met with Minister of Finance Tito Mboweni to stress test proposals to boost South Africa's economic growth. He's director of Harvard Center for International Development, Professor Ricardo Hausmann. Good evening, Professor, and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for your kind invitation. It's great to be with your radio listeners.
And great to hear you on such a clear line all the way from Cambridge, Massachusetts. You're also a frequent guest of the Center for Development and Enterprise, and Executive Director of the Center, Anne Bernstein, is also on the line. Good evening, Anne.
Good evening. Great to be on the show with you and with Ricardo.
And we round up our panel tonight with Sean Hagedorn, who's an independent strategy advisor with us in our fine music radio studio in Cape Town. So we certainly have a well-travelled panel tonight. Sean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Michael.
Professor Hausmann, given that we have seen precious little real reform impetus in terms of new thinking from the new administration yet, what advice did that meeting with the minister yield? What did you offer in terms of advice when you met with our finance minister in December?
Well, let me not get into the details of our private conversation, but let me say the following. South Africa has just gone into one of the most radical experiments ever done on an economy. It approved and imposed the highest minimum wage as a share of median wages in the known part of this galaxy. There is no other country that has imposed such a high minimum wage relative to average wages. And we thought, and I thought, that was going to be a very negative shock to several things, but including to employment, right? I would have expected unemployment to go up. I would also expect that to be bad for competitiveness and exports and so on, and it would slow down the economy. So in some sense, what you're seeing is not the consequence of lack of reform. It's the consequence of very ambitious reforms of a certain kind. That in my view of the world, these outcomes that you're seeing now were expected. And in my conversations with President Ramaphosa, I told him that while he says that jobs is a priority, I said to him, you know, it's very clear that jobs are not your only priority, because you seem to care a lot about the wages of those that already have jobs. And there might be a trade-off between the wages of those that already have jobs and the likelihood that others will get jobs. And that the political dynamics in the country prioritize one group over the other. And in some sense, that's what we're observing now.
It was an unfortunate prediction made by many other economists as well. And when we look at this, the excessive minimum wage is also impacting Colombia, for example, ability to generate a shortage of formal jobs. And it's led to a rise in informal activity. So no surprises that we're seeing this happen. But in a country where the real politic is heavily influenced by the voting power of the labor unions, what is a more appropriate solution that is not going to be politically unpalatable?
Well, South Africa has had minimum wages in the past. We've done it in different sectors so that you could adjust it and at different levels. And we would certainly have rather preferred to have stayed with that system where you're not imposing a high national minimum wage across the entire economy, especially at a time when firms are struggling to survive in this economy. So we think that it was ill-advised. The Treasury predicted that nearly 1 million jobs, or close to 1 million jobs, could be affected negatively by the introduction of the minimum wage. So I agree entirely with Ricardo's view here. And it is true that this is not South Africa's key priority. We keep talking, but we don't get results. So last year, the president called a job summit, and we were very skeptical of what would emerge from that. Lots of attention on small projects, almost no attention on policy reform, and 9 months on, a report has just been issued showing that very, very little has been achieved. And now we're told they're going to have monthly meetings of the social partners, business, labor, and government, to look at all these projects and try and make progress. So South Africa keeps either doing the wrong reforms, like the national minimum wage, or everybody wants to spend inordinate amounts of time on small projects. And when you think of the scale of unemployment, we're now over 10 million people who want to work, who cannot find jobs. Small projects are the wrong place in which to put your attention. We need to fix the environment to encourage firms to start up and to employ people who have very few skills.
And unfortunately, Sean, to bring you in here, the rhetoric is one of creating decent work, not just of creating work. And we saw it when the Department of Labour was renamed in the new cabinet to reflect the new priority of employment. It's now the Department of Labour and Employment. And the new Labour minister, Tula Ngesi, had to placate COSATU because COSATU was upset that the Labour minister would now be focusing on employment creation. It's cloud cuckoo land stuff.
Yeah, the positive side of it is that the problems are at the policy level. So I think just about everything that Professor Hausman and the CDE produce, and I'm a great fan of their work, so I'm not going to be disagreeing with their opinions. One thing I would like to focus on is that if people are employed, then employers have a real commercial incentive to invest in those people, and then they become more productive. So that's the one point. And then the other thing, which I hope the professor and Anne could comment on, the only way forward that I see, but I think there are great opportunities, is by really surging value-added exports, and that's where the policies need to shift. And at the same time, though, also people need to get a better understanding of what's happening on the household level, which is very, very negative. And that South Africa's binding constraint is that there just isn't sufficient purchasing power within the local economy to grow a way out of where we are.
And Professor, I'd like to lead in with that, what you'd like to see from a policy perspective. If we could somehow deal with the national minimum wage, I don't know how one puts the genie back into the bottle there, but you recently wrote that just because a tire is flat at the bottom doesn't mean that the hole is there. And as with a flat tire, a dearth of good jobs doesn't mean that the labor market is the problem. So where is the real problem in South Africa?
Well, I think that there are several problems in South Africa that need attention. People in South Africa complain about skills shortages, and there is a very low unemployment rate for university graduates and a very, very high unemployment rate for people with matric or less. And that suggests that there's an imbalance between the kinds of combinations of work that the market is demanding and the one that the society is able to supply. A solution for that is immigration, high-skilled immigration. High-skilled immigration would relax the skills constraint It would relax, it would lower the skill premium that those with education are getting. It would lower inequality, and it would increase demand for the low-skilled South Africans that are looking for jobs. So I think this is costs nothing from a fiscal point of view. It would generate resources from a fiscal point of view, and it would improve competitiveness, exports, whatever you want. So that's a very simple policy. We have to remember that there's a global competition for talent, and the world is taking South African talent out of South Africa, but South Africa is not trying to compete by attracting foreign talent. There are some numbers that I think are important to remember. Everybody wants to become Silicon Valley. What people don't know is that the STEM workers, the science, technology, engineering, and mathematics workers in Silicon Valley, 54% of them are foreigners. So Silicon Valley is competitive because it attracts talent to Silicon Valley. Now, the other 46% are not Californians. California would be a country, if it were an independent state, would be a country of 40 million people, the size essentially of South Africa. But only 18% are Californians. The rest are from the rest of the United States. So the secret of having, a very competitive, attractive place is its ability to be so cool, be so sexy, be so attractive that everybody wants to go and share their lives with you. And that's an agenda that's completely off limits in South Africa at a huge cost. So South Africa is losing the talent that it has, and it's not willing to compensate it with the talent that it can attract. And that's one important element. A second important element is that in order to work, people have to get together to go to work. And one of the legacies of apartheid has been this physical separation. So transportation costs, commute times are very high in South Africa. So I suggested that we need an urban strategy for South Africa that is based on densification. That's, you don't want urban sprawl, you want to have more compact, denser cities with lower distances for transportation. You want to have housing closer to the areas of growth. And that can be a very interesting jobs-creating agenda in the construction of the new urban infrastructure and the construction of the new urban transportation structure, housing, transportation, and so on, that will create cities that are more compact, that are more efficient, and where these commute costs are less of a constraint on labor force participation.
On that particular...
And finally, you can pay for a lot of this. You can pay for a lot of this in ways that have been used in other countries. Since you're densifying the city, you're allowing people to build more floors per surface area of land. That increases the value of the land. You can have them pay for that privilege by maybe either explicitly paying for it or implicitly building, infrastructure for social use, maybe schools, maybe parks, maybe other things that would make the private sector pay for that privilege as a contribution to that process, so that it would cost very little fiscal money to move in that direction. So those are just some ideas on how to relax some of the constraints that I think are binding.
I think skills is certainly a big one and shouldn't be too difficult if one can get over the political aversion to change at a policy level. Urban densification, I know, Anne, is something that the CDE really has driven, and I just want to stay on the urban densification for a moment, because a lot of what I hear when it comes to land reform in the country and the need for so-called expropriation without compensation, which is seemingly a direct threat on property rights, is for government to help deal with the demand for urban land and the fact that we are seeing a rapid urbanization in the country. Professor Hausman, what impact is this expropriation without compensation policy having on the country's perception out there? And you should know what happens when one fiddles with property rights in Venezuela, for example.
Well, I mean, the story of, you know, you have a story, a very dramatic story across the border in Zimbabwe. But let's assume that that process is, you know, water under the bridge and it's already gone. The question is, the people who are going to get agricultural land, are they going to be connected to the value chains that make so much of South African agriculture globally competitive? Or are they going to be in a separate value chain that doesn't have the elements that make South Africa so competitive? I was amazed at looking at the number of different agricultural products that South Africa exports very competitively abroad. These are very high-tech industries. They're very well-sourced in terms of inputs, raw materials, seeds, fertilizers, agrochemicals, logistics, storage, marketing, financing. And I would want to see that whoever becomes a new farmer or, you know, is a farmer that now gets land, that they are able to produce the kinds of products that feed these value chains and that they use these value chains. But when I read the policy manifesto that was published last January, it had a bunch of bad things to say about those value chains. It had a bunch of bad things to say about those supplies of agro-services and inputs and so on, that they were essentially white monopoly capital and so on, and that you wanted to have some kind of separate development path. I would say whoever gets land should be empowered with the ability to connect to these extremely productive value chains that anybody else in the developing world would envy, because they're you know, so productive and so efficient. And I would encourage much more collaboration between the new farmers, and I would advise for a policy that would offer new farmers or these new property farmers the ability to you know, source their inputs, source their financing, sell their products, to use the technology, use the accreditation of productive schemes that exist.
And this antagonism towards what works in South Africa, this label of white monopoly capital, and as the professor referenced, wanting to develop things separately, really lies at the heart of much of what ails us.
I would slightly differently from you, Michael. I think in the rural areas, Ricardo puts it very well. The real capacity in rural South Africa lies in our commercial agricultural enterprises. And that's where you've got to start. You've got to build on where the country has capacity. Our local governments are collapsing or dysfunctional or totally corrupt. So we should stop introducing policies that pretend we can fix this overnight. We can't. So that's in the rural areas. In the urban areas, we need a much greater understanding of urban markets if we are to go along the lines of densification. And what people need in urban South Africa primarily is not land. They need a secure place to stay that's close to job opportunities. So underlying a lot of this, and your question, is that the country needs a different attitude and understanding of how the private sector and competitive markets work. Instead of shouting slogans or seeing private firms as the enemy, we need to change the way in which the politicians and policymakers think about the private sector and enroll the power of markets in helping to improve the lives of millions of rural and urban South Africans. And we won't do that if we throw slogans around, and we certainly are going to disrupt what is good in rural South Africa and starting to work in terms of integrating new farmers into value chains if we expropriate land without compensation. And if we do it in the urban areas and invite local authorities to identify land for expropriation, this is a recipe for disaster, frankly. Mm.
And Sean, back to your earlier point about what are our competitive export-led and driven opportunities in the agri and agri-processing value chains, to Professor Hausman and Anne Bernstein's points earlier, that is really an area we should be leveraging.
Right. I certainly agree with the professor's points about how South Africa's ability to compete in farming is very impressive. But and I'd be very happy to hear his comments on this. But just generally, to see farming as a source of economic development, I mean, generally the trends towards broad prosperity have been involving urbanization, with which both Anne and the professor have made those points. So you should want to maximize the amount of upliftment that you can create in the rural areas. But if you really want to create large number of jobs, I mean, if you look around the world, the big trend has been towards urbanization, and you don't really create a whole lot of upliftment by seeking to create farming jobs, even though South Africa can improve a lot in that regard if they respect property rights. And there's a tremendous diffusion of skills and abilities, because farming is very, very difficult. It seems like low-skilled people can make a living as farmers, and maybe 3 out of 4 years they can't, but that fourth year can be very frequently devastating.
Professor, to respond to Sean's point, I know a fundamental question that economists ask is why people in some parts of the world are just able to produce so much more value than people in other places or in the same place at earlier times. And I think a big part of that answer often is technology. Do we have the technology to be able to compete?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that as I look at South Africa's agricultural exports, and I don't know enough about the domestic consumption of agriculture. I don't have ready access to those data, but I mean, you're exporting $1.6 billion a year in citrus products. You're exporting $700 million in grapes, $600 million in wine. You're exporting $600 million in apples. You are exporting peaches, nuts, corn, fruit juices, etc., etc. So you have an enormously varied, diversified export basket. You have a very diversified agricultural base, because your geography is different and so on. And I'm sure that there's interesting and important ways in which you can connect farming to all of these value chains. Now, it is true that agriculture has been mostly shedding labor worldwide, because productivity increases have been growing. So I tell countries that they need an agricultural strategy. It may not be their employment strategy, because many parts of agriculture are not terribly labor intensive. But there are some that are. And one of the things that has been growing by leaps and bounds in many countries lately, the last decade or so, have been agriculture in greenhouses. And agriculture in greenhouses tends to have an employment factor per hectare, which is something like 14 times that of extensive agriculture. So there are areas where there's significant employment and growth opportunities in some parts of those value chains. Again, South Africa is very diversified in terms of land qualities and climate and and so on, and there's a great set of diverse technologies to exploit that that diversity. But I'm optimistic that rural incomes can increase significantly with the coming, with the evolving agricultural revolution. I have friends in this agro-tech sector that are incredibly optimistic about the potential for increased yields, lower wastage, and the appearance of very new and very valuable products. You know, for example, when I was a kid, there were avocados in Venezuela, and there were very few avocados elsewhere. But right now, avocados has been a boom industry in Chile. That was a non-traditional producer in Peru. Mexico used to produce 85% of all the world's avocados, and now they've seen a lot more competition. But the market for avocados has expanded so dramatically that they haven't suffered at all. The market is just just taking all of these new products very significantly. So I think that there's a very nice, optimistic story to say about the future of agriculture. You know, there's been massive improvements in technology on water management that would make some parts of South Africa that are constrained by water shortage and even climate change, you know, able to cope better and maybe even to expand and grow. So I'm positive and optimistic about that, and there are plenty of more jobs in the agricultural value chain than in agriculture itself.
We wrap this up, are you optimistic about the future of the South African economy under the current administration?
Well, let me put it this way. I'm hopeful. I see the potential in the country. I see the potential in the society. This is a place that has very complicated politics, and I see a lot of contradictions in what the ANC has said publicly, and what the ANC has committed to publicly. I mean, the idea of expropriation without compensation, and the idea of the highest minimum wage in the galaxy. And this is an amazingly risky endeavor. So no country in the world has ever set minimum wages so close to the median wage. Mm. It has never happened. It's the first time in history that a country attempts to do that. In a country so heterogeneous, where the proper minimum wage for Cape Town may be radically different from the proper minimum wage for Northern Cape.
I've had many people shaking their heads. Professor, I'm sorry to interject, but I have to stop you there as we have run out of time. I think equally Douglas Adams' words in the famous Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy mentioning don't panic might be etched across the South African economy at the moment. Professor Ricardo Hausmann from the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, and Bernstein from the Center for Development and Enterprise, and Sean Hagedorn, our Independent Strategy Advisor. Thank you so much for a fascinating panel. Thanks to sound engineers Matabatabarodebe, Mawanda Lorbe in Cape Town, and producer Andries